dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people in Washington, D.C. whose understanding of the various dimensions of and the enormous stakes associated with our times aspect of this war for the free world, a multi-generational challenge, as my old boss Ronald Reagan used to say, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. His name is Mike Gonzalez. He is a senior fellow at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, where he also has the distinction of being the E Pluribus Unum Fellow. Prior to joining Heritage, Mike has spent, a lifetime of really investigative journalism, reporting, analysis. He's worked at a number of government posts during the George W. Bush administration, including as a speechwriter for an old friend, Chairman Christopher Cox at the Securities and Exchange Commission and in the State Department's European Bureau. He's the author of a number of important books, including The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free, and a brand new and absolutely terrific book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Mike, congratulations on this new, extremely important, and very timely contribution to our understanding of what's going on in America. And thank you for taking an hour to talk with us about it. It's great to have you back.
Frank, thank you very much. You understand the nature of the challenge. And something in what you just said reminded me that this is the 30th anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. You worked for Ronald Reagan. You and I spent the balance of our lives in the Cold War. And we had this enemy. For decades, the United States led the effort to defeat communism. We spent all our resources into it. And we thought we had defeated it in 1991 when the Soviet flag was lowered on the Kremlin. And here we are. Here we are fighting communists and Marxists inside the gate now.
Right. Inside the wire, as they say. And Mike, that's really where I wanted to start. Your book is about Marxist revolution. You've observed it firsthand in your native Cuba. But I'm so glad you reminded me of this anniversary, because it seems we've really forgotten what Lenin introduced to the world in the revolution that he brought to the people of Russia at horrific cost to them and the world more generally over the years. Talk a little bit about the tenets of these Marxist revolutions as practiced by, well, not only Lenin and his successors, but Mao and Fidel Castro, among others.
Well, one thing, and that is very relevant to what Americans see today, is this denigration, this hatred of everything that came before them, of the culture of the country that it is trying to take over. Marxists are like parasites. They feast off a culture, but as they do that, they destroy it. And that is what we see in every Marxist revolution, that they come in. The Bolsheviks, as you know, hated Russian culture, not just the Tsar, whose family they massacred, little kids, but they hated Russian culture itself. Pol Pot was the culmination of this. I mean, he came in 1975 into Phnom Penh and actually called it Year Zero. I saw it with Castro in the early 60s, where everything that had come before 1959, New Year's Eve, the day he takes over, is corrupt and petty and bad. And of course, you know, those who go to Havana today will notice that nothing has been built. The ruins that you see are the ruins of the mansions that were built in 500 years prior to Castro, but nothing since of any value has been built. And again, today, we see the denigration of American culture, the attempt to erase everything. The great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, cannot have a high school named after him in San Francisco because all of a sudden he's a bad man. He's a racist, never mind all the founders who gave shape to our nation. So that is a threat, a common thread that you see with all these revolutions, Frank.
It's so fascinating. Yesterday, the last statue memorializing men who fought in the Civil War was removed from the main drag in Richmond, and Robert E. Lee's statue was cut in half. And this is just an example of the kind of effort made in the name of Black Lives Matter, BLM, that we've seen taking hold in our country. And Mike, I just want to ask you, at the end of the day, the object of Black Lives Matter and these other Marxist revolutionaries, including, you talk about them in the book, Antifa, and Liberation Road and Freedom Road Socialist Organization and others that are in this mix, have as their central purpose what Barack Obama famously promised on the eve of his first election, is the fundamental transformation of America. What does a fundamentally transformed America look like if it is to their likes?
You know, that is a question that I get asked all the time. And the reason why I grope for an answer is because, starting with Marx and Engels, right, they never really formulate something firm about what they want. If you read, if you have the misfortune of having to trust through Marcuse or Max Horkheimer or Gramsci, they let you know what they want. And what they want is central planning. It's a command economy. It's collectivism. They don't think much of the individual. They have this really psychotic hatred of individual private property. And it's the same thing with the critical race theorists of today and with Black Lives Matter. They have a hatred of capitalism. They go out of their way to say that capitalism is racist. Of course, that is, they're fabulists. You know, that is a falsehood. Capitalism is colorblind. You know, if you can produce a good cheaper and better than your competitor, it doesn't matter what your pigmentation is. People are going to want to buy it. The whole system is based on that. And capitalism itself is a Marxist term for just freedom, right? I have a pen in my hand, and if you want to buy it, we agree on a price that makes us both walk away happy. They want to get rid of that. They Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, the founders and leaders of Black Lives Matter. By the way, let me just say very early on what I mean by Black Lives Matter. I mean the organizations, right? The concept is unimpeachable. Black Lives Matter to me. I don't say all lives matter. Obviously, all lives matter. But I think it's important to say Black Lives Matter. Why is that? Because Blacks have had it uniquely bad in our history. Slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, etc. We have strived to fix these problems, and we have a great deal. But so the concept itself is unimpeachable. It is the organizations, especially the founders of these organizations, that demonstrate in my book. They are Marxists who hate freedom, who hate capitalism, who hate the government treating the people equally, who hate the ability to own private property. When confronted with the fact that she owns three homes, Patrice Cullors, her response is, "Well, I see that as family property." There's a background to that. To Engels, you know, family property or community property was fine. What really bothers these people, and they're crazy, I think, is individual private property, and the fact that you can alienate it, the fact that you can sell it. So what do they want to put in its place? All of them is a command economy, which they see as rational. They think that what you and I like, the freedom to trade, is irrational because it's not guided by a central command.
By people who are better than you and me and who will have a better plan than we might come up with. But at the end of the day, Mike, and again, as someone whose life has been directly impacted by the application of this Marxist revolutionary agenda, isn't it fundamentally less about economics or models of how economics should be organized than it is about power? And when all is said and done, isn't the fundamental transformation of a country like the United States about consolidating power in the hands of the revolutionaries and having them henceforward be in control, not just of our economic affairs, but of virtually every aspect of our lives? And haven't we watched around the world what happens when people actually accomplish that consolidation of power? It's a devastating effect.
Right. Everything you just said is right. I mean, this is Ronald Reagan's old dictum that the left, whatever they don't want to ban, they want to mandate. They don't like individual will. They have a will to power. Look at the treatment that Larry Elder received. I believe it was in Venice, California, when he visited this week. He had objects thrown at him, epithets hurled at him. His entourage received the blows from these leftists who were there. And by the way, not a very large crowd. They can never gather a large crowd because there's very few of them. However, what distinguishes them is what you just said, the will to power. The fact that they're not encumbered by fear, but by conscience. You know, they will apply pressure and coercion, and they don't care how much other people suffer. That's why the list of people murdered by communism is in the millions and millions and millions in China, the Soviet Union, Cambodia, Cuba, etc. It's a perfect at only one thing, Frank, at failing. You know, God tries really hard, and he even senses perfect laboratories. He senses North Korea. He senses East Germany and West Germany. He says, look at this, look at this, look at one side and look at the other. Choose. And yet we have people still today who want to implement Marxism. By the way, Patrice Colors, in a recent video, she made very clear that the only reason she does not use the word communist is because she thinks it gets a bad rap. That's what she said. It gets a bad rap in America. It's you know, capitalism has been very good with its PR and the American dream. So, but she proudly calls herself a Marxist. But she says, you know, communism, it's just got a bad rap. But you and I know that Marxism is just a synonym for communism. She's obviously a communist. She's not a member of the party because, you know, as Angela did, the party was something my dad did. It was just a bunch of old people, even though she herself joined the party and ran as I said, the Communist Party.
So when you break this down, and so you do very, very impressively, this new book, and again, we're talking with its author, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. And thank you for, you know, in elaborating on what about BLM you're talking about, Mike, and I think you're absolutely right to focus in on the organization that has brought it to us and is trying to impose it upon us in a classic Marxist fashion. But isn't it the case that racism, which is at the core of this enterprise, the charge specifically that the United States is systemically racist, is really just a manifestation of the old Marxist sort of class warfare with race and identity politics, the subject of your previous book, being used to divide and conquer in much the way Marx envisioned class being used elsewhere?
Right. That's exactly what they've done. They figured in the 20s and 30s, Gramsci and the Frankfurt School, in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, they look, oh my God, this is not happening. the proletariat, the working class, is not rising up everywhere and overthrowing the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie. The worker has false consciousness. He likes the nation state. He likes the family. He likes the free market system, and he likes God and the church. So he's got false consciousness, and we need to re-educate the worker, and they understand that culture is really what matters. Obviously, when that mutates here, when that comes to the United States, race is the big thing in our lives. Race is the sine qua non of America, of America. So because what is also sex, by the way, what do they have in common? You cannot change your race or your family background, you know, your nation of origin, and newsbreak here, Frank, you cannot change your sex. So then they make it a war, not a class-based war, not a class-based conflict, but a race-based conflict. If that is exactly right, as you put it, that is just a cover. You know, it's funny because the old Trotskyites, the old dyed-in-the-wool communists, and the new ones, like the Jacobin, they take issue with identity politics because they say, well, that's race-based. We need to go back to class-based. We need to go back to economic determinism. And the new cultural Marxists say, they call them vulgar Marxists. They say that's vulgar Marxism. They think their Marxism is much more sophisticated. And in some ways it is, because they understand that it is based on something you cannot change. However, this is a complete cover. What they want is central command. What they want is power. As you said, just look at the way it's treated. Look at what Derek Bell wrote about Clarence Thomas. You know, Clarence Thomas. I can assure you right now that he's black. And yet, when he was appointed, Derek Bell wrote this long diatribe in which he called them everything. I cannot even say it in this interview. Derek Bell, obviously, the godfather of critical race theory. So this is not about, you know, people. He was saying, well, I just want Harvard Law to hire African Americans. No, he didn't want, when George Herbert Walker Bush hired Clarence Thomas to go to the Supreme Court, he was furious. So it's not about your pigmentation, after all. It's about your beliefs. You must be a Marxist.
Yeah, you have to conform to their ideology as well as their agenda. Which brings me to the very interesting point that you make in, I think, Chapter 3 of the new book about BLM, Mike, and that is the degree to which, while there have been black impetuses behind this sort of racist approach, and I think that's the term for it, that BLM is promoting. It is decrying racism, of course, but it is instituting its own form of it. And we'll talk more about critical race theory and all of that in a moment. But this particular chapter caught my eye because you talk about the degree to which white revolutionaries have been instrumental in training and organizing and empowering these black Marxists in the BLM organization, among other places. Give us just a flavor of how, for example, the Weather Underground, you know, helped shape the current revolution in our midst.
Thank you for saying that. The Weather Underground, for those who are not ancient like you and me, was obviously an FBI designated a terrorist organization in the 60s and 70s. They were all white. They were very white and very stupid. They were really bad at killing people. They ended up killing themselves when they tried to set off bombs. But they wanted to do was terrorize. You know, they were rich kids too. They were mostly rich kids. And so they failed miserably. They did not introduce revolution through terrorism. But they had to go on the ground because they were wanted by the FBI for killing people or trying to kill people. They did kill a few people that they intended to kill. So one of them is Eric Mann, who served time in prison, a former weatherman. And then he gets out. He establishes the Labor Community Strategy Center in L.A. And then in 2003, he recruits, this is his word, by the way, in which he writes, in Playbook for Progressives, a book you wrote, which I recommend people read. I always read the left. Do not read the right. Read, except me. Read me. I'm a conservative, but read me. But always read the left. Yeah. So Eric Mann describes in Playbook for Progressives how he recruited Patrice Cullors when she was just very young, 2003. And he then trains her into Marxism. She herself, by the way, writes about this a lot. She gives him credit. She doesn't shy away from this. And when she says in interviews, well, I'm a trained Marxist, and Alicia Garza is a trained Marxist, this is what she means. This is why I say in my book, The Weather Underground has been far more successful at acting in this century through the proxy of others, because as you know, there's another former Weather Underground personality who gets out, who spends time in prison, but then she goes to work for a foundation that funds BLM, funds the BLM Global Network Foundation, which is the main Global Network Foundation, by the way. And in her name, I'm trying to look for it here, I believe it's Rosenberg. Susan Rosenberg, who then gets on the board of Thousand Currents, which becomes the fiscal sponsor of Black Lives Matter Global Networks Foundation until about a few months ago, until about a year ago, when it became too much to have another terrorist from the Weather Underground being on the foundation that was the fiscal sponsor of the main Black Lives Matter organizations.
More than the traffic would bear, huh? That's somewhat encouraging. It actually did become a liability.
Yeah. So they changed to the Tide Foundation. The Tide Foundation is no better, of course. It's another funder of leftist causes. But here you have Susan Rosenberg and Eric Mann, two weathermen, playing key roles in our lives today, to a degree that they did not achieve in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the Tides Foundation, of course, is the creature of Teresa Hines Carey, John Carey's wife, and is a big-time funder of a whole host of radical leftist and Marxist causes, as you say. And that brings me to a very important part of this remarkable book, this really courageous book. Mike Gonzalez, and I commend you for the clarity with which you approach some of these extremely fraught issues. The woke capitalists, as you call them, who are helping to underwrite this Marxist revolutionary movement, the Black Lives Matter organization. It's not, alas, confined to, you know, the odd philanthropists like Teresa Hines Carey. It's all kinds of foundations and corporations as well. Give us a sense of the magnitude of the money that's being put into the coffers of Black Lives Matter organizations by such outfits and the implications of it for not just, you know, the advance of this revolution, but for our country.
Yeah, and I never took psychology classes or psychiatry classes at school, so I don't understand why these capitalists give this money. Other than many times it's the children of the capitalists. Not in the case of Soros, he himself does it, George Soros. But why they give so much money to causes and groups that want to undermine capitalism. It reminds me of Henry Ford III when he resigned from the Ford Foundation. He sent them a letter in the 1970s saying, all the money that you use to undermine capitalism was created by capitalism. I just want to remind you of it on my way out the door. And so it's the same way here. The Ford Foundation continues to give money, gives a lot of money to these leftist causes. But you're quite right. Warren Buffett, son Peter, his foundation has given a lot of money. He started investing heavily into, if investing is the right word for it, into the group that went on to become Thousand Currents, which then becomes the fiscal sponsors of a lot of Black Lives Matter organizations. George Soros' son, what is his name? It escapes me at the moment. Warren Buffett's son is Peter. And George he gives a lot of money too, but you have all these corporations as well giving all this money. Black Lives Matter GNF raises $100 million last year. This is $100 million that's not going to do a lot of good for us is going to create a lot of problems. And you have to. And good Americans, by the way, a lot of individual Americans. It's not just Nike and Soros and Peter Buffett. It's a lot of individual Americans who either because they want a virtue signal, or because they actually feel white guilt, they feel guilt, and or because they're moved by what they see. Right, the journalists have done a very bad job of describing what Black Lives Matter is about, the organizations they have covered for them rather than cover them. So, you know, we have a lot of good Americans with good intentions who give a lot of money to Black Lives Matter because they want social justice, except they're not going to get social justice. They're going to get a great deal of injustice.
I think his name is Alexander Soros.
Alexander yeah. Soros. Yeah. Yes, Alexander.
Robert is also one of his, I guess he's his former chief investment officer, but I think you're thinking of Alexander. So when you aggregate the kind of money we're talking about, it is stunning that there would be this kind of wellspring from which people who are seeking the destruction of our country, rather explicitly, fundamental transformation is a euphemism for it, but let's be clear, it is about overthrowing our government and turning it into a Marxist entity that will inevitably translate into the end of America as we've known it, and many of us have loved it. To the detriment, by the way, let's be clear, of Black people as well as other ethnic, you know, groups in our country, to the detriment of all Americans. That's how this model plays out. And again, you understand that better than anybody, I think, Mike Gonzalez. Which brings me to the question of how the sort of community of people seeking this outcome are engaging, as we've seen most notably in 2020, in not only behavior that would be, I think, unacceptable to most of us, but that is violent and lawless and clearly of a revolutionary character. How are they getting away with this? In the absence, evidently, of any willingness to enforce the law or even correctly characterize the nature of their program on the part of the sort of elite in our government, in our media, and you know, more generally in our country, including the business community, as we've talked about.
Oh, boy, I'm going to try to compress what would be a very long answer. First, let me address what you were saying. Alicia Garza, in some ways, one of the most important of the three, although Patrice Cloche is also very important. Alicia Garza went to Maine in 2019 and to speak to a group of very eager New England leftists and made her point very clearly. And people can come up. She said, what we want is to dismantle the organizing principle of this society. We need to dismantle how we're organized as a country. It's not just the government that they want to upend. It's everything. When they talk about systemic racism and the need to replace the system, they mean every nook and cranny. And you've alluded a couple of times to my having spent the first 12 years of my life under communism, and I saw this. You know, I also think that the many, many years I lived as a foreign correspondent overseas, including Korea, where I saw the transition. I've also lived under Francisco Franco, so I saw fascism in its dying stages. So I could tell you that what they seek is the systemic change of the very system. And they say that. They don't hide it. Now, why don't people know that? The first culprit is the press. The press will not report on this. And they've made it very clear that, you know, objectivity is out the door. The dean of Columbia Journalism School, I'm very sorry to say, was celebrated the fact that the old shibboleth of objectivity was finally gotten rid of. And so they've embraced this, and they say they called it the year of riots, the burning cities of 2020, a year of racial reckoning. So they give a very one-sided, and I would say false view of what took place. But then our political class, Frank, also needs to come in for some criticism. Both parties, the Republican Party, it has not covered itself in glory. There are very few politicians who will name Black Lives Matter. Why? Because of what I said earlier, that the concept is unimpeachable. So they shy away from it. This is why you see politicians pounding the table about Antifa. I have a chapter in my book about this. Antifa is nowhere near the threat that is Black Lives Matter. Antifa may be more outwardly. We don't know a lot about Antifa, but we know it seems to be mostly white, or a lot more white than Black Lives Matter. So it becomes an easier target if you're a politician, a conservative politician. They're also anarchists. They're not Marxists, really. And they don't have a coherent set of beliefs, a coherent ideology behind them, the way that Black Lives Matter does. So I think Black Lives Matter is a more existential threat for many, 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 which I think we can continue on in the rest of the interview. But we don't know about this because our media and our political class refuse to confront this. What I write in my book, a lot of it, all of it, is public information, by the way. I didn't unearth anything that is not publicly known, but nobody...
But it reflects a lot of great research, by the way, Mike. I'm very impressed by the depth in which you've been able to, plumb these various sources and make them available to all of us. It's a real public service.
Well, that's very nice of you. And if you go into the footnotes, you will see it's mostly, by and large, leftist sources. But, just to close, to put a bow on this, PolitiFact, egregiously said, are they Marxist? Not really. And by the way, what does Marxism mean today? This is PolitiFact, Frank. What does Marxism mean today? It means looking at life through an equal lens. Frank, I'm an MBA. I look at life through an economic lens. I don't think anybody's ever called me a Marxist.
They haven't, and rightly so, because you want no part of it, Mike, and you have been doing yeoman work in helping the rest of us understand why we shouldn't either. But again, I'm just struck whether you're right in singling out the media for having essentially given these guys a complete pass on any criticism, and mostly having been completely in the tank for them, for their agenda. But the government, those in the executive branch, even under Donald Trump, certainly many in Congress were mostly holding their fire, I think. It's fair to say they were pulling their punches. And I'm particularly thinking, Mike, I would just like you to tease this out a little bit, if you would, about law enforcement. Some of this was a function of, state authorities refusing to use their powers, use their state police and National Guard, for that matter, to try to stop BLM-inspired and, in many cases, conducted mayhem in the streets, Portland, Oregon being just one example of this phenomenon. But where's law enforcement been, like at the federal level in particular? Why is it that they have not been more active? You touch in your book about the history of J. Edgar Hoover, the founder of the FBI. He has to be spinning at a very high RPM to see what his agency has become in terms of if not actually an enabler of some of this activity, certainly not much of an impediment to it.
Yeah, I mean, look, J. Edgar Hoover got Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, under Jack Kennedy, to agree to sign off on a wiretap of Martin Luther King. Why is that? Because Martin Luther King, there was a man in his entourage who was a member of the Communist Party, had just recently been a member of the Communist Party, and had resigned when he joined Martin Luther King's entourage. Now, that's not to say that Martin Luther, I don't believe Martin Luther King was a communist at all, but the reason why Robert Kennedy signed off to it was because they had been this association with Stanley Levinson. Stanley Levinson, again, was a communist who met with a Kremlin, would go to New York, men with agents of the Kremlin, as he was advising Martin Luther King on what to do. Again, I don't believe that Martin Luther King was a communist at all, But yes, J. Edgar Hoover, actually Robert Kennedy wiretapped Martin Luther King. Director Comey, his successor, kept a letter of that wiretap in his top drawer when he was head of the FBI, so he would not repeat this mistake. But he wiretapped other people. But the FBI, every time it tried to, especially post-Ferguson, right? Ferguson is when all these communists congregate with Black Lives Matter. And I do mean communists. Communist Party USA was there, as were, Freedom Road and Liberation Road and all the other Marxist-Leninist groups in America. They congregate in Maoist, in Ferguson in November to plan and come up with a blueprint. The FBI tried to follow these events, and the Congressional Black Caucus went after them and called Director Wray in and said, what are you doing? You can't do this. So eventually, the FBI had to give up. And a lot of these activities were First Amendment protected activities. I don't think the FBI should be looking at First Amendment protected activities. However, when it crosses over into violence, yeah, I think that's fair game, actually. Anybody who wants to violently overthrow our system obviously should be looked into and prosecuted. But you also have the, as you very well know, the problem of rogue prosecutors. When the
Soros prosecutors,
yeah, George Soros pays for them. My colleagues here at the Heritage Foundation, Coley Stimson and Laura Rees and Zach Smith have done really good work on this. One of them, by the way, one of these rogue prosecutors elected with Soros money is Chesa Boudin. Chesa Boudin, as you know, is the son of two former weathermen, one who has just been given amnesty by Governor Cuomo as he was leaving office in New York, Chesa Boudin's father. But who raised Chesa Boudin? Well, my God, Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorn. Bill Ayers, another weatherman, he's the one that introduced Barack Obama to the Chicago political world. All these things are very connected. And he also had to go on the ground. He raised this rogue prosecutor.
This is a chilling example of how this Marxist revolution is continuing apace. And I think that it behooves us, Mike, to spend a couple of minutes before we have to let you go, talking about how it's being institutionalized in our government, in our schools, and in our society more generally. You develop this at some length in the book, this so-called critical race theory agenda. The essence of it, it seems to me, is a racist enterprise. But talk a little bit about the agenda. Talk about how it is now being advanced, notably by the Biden administration, but through other channels as well, and the implications if it is not effectively countered.
So, Frank, today, people will say, you never hear about Black Lives Matter anymore. Why did Gonzalez write this book, and why is Frank talking to him? Today, our lives are deeply impacted by this. I talk about the twin legacies of Black Lives Matter. One is the horrendous spike in homicide rates in our cities. That is directly linked to the police pulling back, to the fact that they're being defunded, and the fact that when they do arrest people, the rogue prosecutors will refuse to prosecute the criminals and will just turn them back on the street. That's legacy number one. But actually, legacy number one really is how critical race theory has entered all of our lives. As I said, if your daughter has spent her semester studying systems of oppression in Guatemala, it's because of Black Lives Matter. If you're being pulled into a training program that uses racist terms in racist practices, it's because of Black Lives Matter. And if Joe Biden is signing into law bills that purposely discriminate against a race, the white race, as he did with the farmer's loan bill, the loan forgiveness bill, which a judge in Florida said, no, you can't do this. You have the little thing called the Constitution.
Unconstitutional.
Right. So for the first time since Jim Crow, a ginormous step backward. We have the government of the United States denying equal protection under the law to some races. That is something that is affecting all of us. It's going to make our lives poorer. You know, Joe Biden, a career politician that never in his whole entire life showed any interest in any of this. Now they put the poor man in front of the teleprompter and he has to read the word equity 19 times in a speech. And of course, he's so used to using equality. Sometimes he says equality and then he backs up of himself and he repeats himself, equity, which means the opposite, by the way. It used to mean the same as equality, but it means now the opposite. It means the government is going to treat us differently depending on our race and depending on the category of oppression that the bureaucracy has put us in. So that is our lives today are very deeply affected by all of this.
Benefit of those listening who may not be as steeped in this as you are, Mike, how would you characterize the essence of this so-called critical race program? You mentioned sort of how it works, but I think people are shocked when they hear what it actually is rooted in. And talk a bit about, you know, what whites are inherently ascribed as being, as well as blacks.
Yeah, it emerges in law schools in the late 70s, but really in the 80s. It's a child of critical legal theory, critical legal studies, except that rather than be colorblind as a critical legal theorist wanted to be, they say, yes, the systems of oppression exist. They're written into the law. We agree with all that. People who do all this are whites. All the rich people and the people who write the laws are white. And what we have is systemic racism. The main belief...
Critical theory, to back the lens up for a second, Mike, was full-on Marxist, was it not?
All three are full-on Marxists. You know, all three. Critical race theory begins in Milwaukee, right, in Madison, in the convent. The critical race theory. It's Kimberly Crenshaw, an academic, who comes up with the name. They hold a conference at this convent, and two or three years later, Richard Delgado, one of the attendees, one of the godfathers of critical race theory, says, "You know, we sat there, you know, 2 dozen of us, looking at the crucifixes and looking at the stained glass windows, and we were thinking, what an odd place for a bunch of Marxists." This is what he said. You know. Max Horkheim, a critical theory. They were complete Marxists in Germany and then in New York in the 30s and 40s. Critical legal theory, Duncan Kennedy and everybody else, a bunch, you know, Roberto Unger, all of them are Marxists, and all of the critical race theorists are Marxists. And the few who do not proclaim they're Marxists will tell you they hate capitalism. Well, if you hate capitalism, there's not a lot of other options.
But we've been seeing people, and I think this goes to the last issue I want to touch on with you, Mike, which is what do we do about all this? We've been seeing parents in various school board meetings around the country very exercised, and understandably so, by their understanding their children are being indoctrinated to believe that whites are inherently racist and oppressive, and blacks are inherently oppressed and the victims of racism, and nothing can alter it because it's in the nature, as you put it earlier, of the pigmentation of their skin. And they want no part of that for their children, nor should any of us, I think. Men and women in uniform are being told the same thing. And many of them are recoiling in horror as well. And yet they're being told they must take this training. They must comport themselves in accordance with it or risk being purged out of the military. I mean, these are really symptoms, are they not, of Marxist revolutionary programs and progress towards their end state of taking us down.
Yeah, no, they must take over all the institutions that Rudy Dutschke said in the 1960s in Marcuse's Disciple. I don't know if you know this, but I've been traveling a lot. The country in the last two or three months, I've been in Denver and Dallas and Chicago and Milwaukee and Madison and Indianapolis. And I'm going to continue to travel. I'm traveling this weekend to Richmond, and then after that, I'm going to go to Missouri. So I'm traveling a lot and I'm seeing a lot. I'm getting hundreds of people. Trust me, I'm not that electrifying a speaker, as your listeners can witness.
I find it pretty electrifying myself. I think they do too. Don't be too modest. Thank you for doing these travels. And what are you finding is the response?
People are really aghast. Because for the first time, don't forget, critical race theory has been inside the faculty lounge for 30 years, meeting no resistance. But now, because of Black Lives Matter, it has jumped the wall. What I like to say is, two bad viruses jumped the lab in 2020, one COVID-19 and the other one CRT, critical race theory. But now they're meeting resistance from parents and workers. And they're saying, what? No, this is racist. Telling my child that because she's black, she should not like reading and writing, or that she should not be punctual, because these are white things. First of all, it's disgusting. Second of all, it's false. And it will ruin her if you say these things to her. By the way, Derek Bell, the godfather of critical race theory, wrote famously in an essay that blacks will always be subservient. They will never reach equality, which is untrue. And to say this to people does a lot of damage, especially if you say it to them when they're young. So we must stop this, Frank, and the American people are very serious about stopping it.
On our way to just a couple of minutes on what we need to be doing, Mike, I just want to note that one of the other things which you sort of introduced there in that comment is the BLM organizers' commitment to destroying the nuclear family, another principle of Marxism. And what should people in this country who prize the nuclear family, who prize their freedoms and the Constitution that guarantees them, who do not want to see our country destroyed and made over fundamentally in the image of just another horrifying Marxist oppressive state, what are your most important recommendations about what they should do?
Well, they should first ask themselves what the threshold of pain is, and then they should act. They should go to school board meetings and speak up. They should call their principal or their teacher of their child, and they should stand up to HR and say, no, I don't like the way, I don't like these trainings. I don't want to go. And that's not going to make me a pariah. And if you fire me for it, you know, there's a legal foundation behind me who's going to take care of me and sue you, because corporations, after all, are very afraid of being sued, or become a whistleblower. You know, if that is too much for you, and I perfectly understand that, and I don't want people, your listeners, to lose their livelihood, to lose their jobs. But, you know, pick up the phone and call Chris Rufo or email Chris Rufo, who's an independent journalist who does a lot of great work on this. Such great work, in fact, that Twitter just took away his blue check mark. This guy is fantastic, by the way. He does great work. Email the Daily Signal, the Heritage Foundation. Email anybody and tell them what your corporation is trying to do to you. What HR is demanding that you do, that you affirm. It's illegal. It's against the law to tell you that you must affirm a political statement. Yes, you can.
As a condition of employment.
As a condition of employment. They can say you have to be here at 9. They can say you only have an hour for lunch. They cannot say you must believe this political belief as a condition of employment.
And espouse it, no, not least. Mike, we have 1 minute left. Just very quickly, when you see how far advanced this Marxist revolution is, do you still have hope that we can save our country?
Frank, I'm incredibly optimistic. I think, and that is a completely a function of the cities that I've been traveling to, I'm seeing an American renaissance. As you know, and political scientists and foreign visitors have remarked for centuries, we are exceptionally attached to liberty. And the American people have not given that up. The American people are still the American people. And they are still uniquely attached to liberty. And they're saying, no. You're not going to do this to us.
If they do rise up, if they meet this challenge, if they are successful in staving off what the Marxists of Black Lives Matter organization and others have in mind for us, it will be in no small measure thanks to your warnings and your illuminating what needs to be done. Mike Gonzalez, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the chance to visit with you and to commend you once again for this courageous, powerful, and extremely well-written, well-researched, and timely book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Keep up the great work at the Heritage Foundation, Mike, and please come back to us again soon with updates on all of this.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In Hollywood, as in life more generally, timing is everything. So it will be interesting to see how a flattering new movie about Dr. Anthony Fauci fares at the box office this weekend. After all, it was preceded by the leak of 900 government documents confirming that President Biden's point man on the COVID pandemic has repeatedly lied about it, including under oath before the Congress. Of particular concern are revelations that Fauci falsely denied having underwritten genetic engineering research in the Chinese biological weapons laboratory in Wuhan, widely believed to be the source of the virus responsible for killing millions around the world, including many Americans. Tony Fauci must be held accountable for his role in enabling this disaster, and then lying about it. Ditto for his funding of Chinese military virologists still working in laboratories in this country. This is Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.